From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. With a black and biracial man and a white woman on the two major presidential tickets, this election will go down as one of the most unusual and dynamic in history. Regardless of the outcome, how has this race changed the political landscape of America? Today, we take a look at how the race has changed the fortunes of Republicans, particularly black Republicans, and the GOP at large. Next week, we'll take a look at the Democrats. For a bit of big picture, we've got Regina Freer and Associate Professor of Politics at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, what do you think this race has done for or against the GOP?
Well, two things. One is, if the polls are correct and Obama does, in fact, secede to the presidency, I think there's several things that have to be considered. One is that the Republicans' relationship to the African-American community has gone from, unfortunately, bad to worse. And the fortunes and the way in which the Republican Party is going to be able to recapture the small percentage of the African-American vote that did go Republican is going to become an even greater challenge. And I think part of the reason is because Obama has actually spoken pretty directly to black Republican issues. And black Republican issues are not that distinct from all Republican voters. That is, there are two wings. There are social conservatives and religious conservatives, and there are fiscal conservatives. And in a time of economic crisis, Obama is talking about fiscal responsibility. And so he's speaking directly to fiscal conservatives.
We have different bloggers come on our show, and so we had a sort of mini roundtable on black conservatives and Republicans and talked to one person who said he was a fiscal conservative and going for Obama, another person who said national security was his top issue and he was going for McCain. So that speaks to some of what you're talking about. What about appointees? You know, we've seen these top appointees, including Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, as secretaries of state. Do you think a McCain administration would appoint a high-profile or several high-profile black Americans?
I think it's possible. We haven't seen a lot of evidence of closeness in terms of advisors who are African-American for McCain. So within his camp, the diversity is somewhat lacking. And so who he would be able to pull from his stable in order to do that is an open question. Bush, we knew coming in, was very close to Condoleezza Rice. And so that was something that was not a surprise necessarily. So we don't necessarily see that in the McCain camp. So I think it's an open question.
The GOP is also expected to lose seats in Congress. How will that affect the big picture?
Well, that actually may work in the favor of the Republicans because everything that happens will be laid at the feet of Democrats. And so I think Republicans will, in fact, lay in waiting and wait for mistakes. And because of the uncertain economic times, that there are invariably going to be some mistakes made because people can't foretell the future. And so I think that the Republicans may, in fact, be able to capitalize and benefit off of the fact that this is a Republican Congress, I mean, a Democratic Congress and a Democratic, presumably, president.
When you think about the issues, you talked about fiscal conservatism. There's certain issues that may appeal to Republican voters, including black Republicans, but what about tactics? You know, you've seen a lot of celebrity appeals by the Obama campaign to younger voters. What tactics might the Republican Party use to try to attract new voters or crossover voters?
Well, if we're talking about new or crossover African-American voters in particular, it's going to be a challenge because young voters as a whole, I think, are really changing the landscape of this election. And they will do so also for African-Americans, that we will have – Obama has energized more young African-American voters. And so how can the Republican Party attract those voters to itself when, in fact, they came into the system because of Obama? It's a huge challenge for the Republican Party. Immigration may be an issue, but once again, for younger voters, that's not playing. The immigration issue is not hitting them in the same way that it is hitting more mature African-American voters. So it's a huge challenge.
Well, Professor, great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
That was Professor Regina Freer. She is Associate Professor of Politics at Occidental College in Los Angeles, and she joined us in our studios here at NPR West. For more, we're going to turn to Michael Steele. He is the chairman of GOPAC, a political action committee working to elect Republicans to office. He's also the former lieutenant governor of Maryland and a Fox News contributor. Thanks for coming back on the show.
It's good to be back with you. How's it going?
Things are going great.
Great.
The campaign isn't over. how has it changed just so far the fortunes of Republicans, including Black Republicans?
Oh, it's very difficult. I mean, the honest answer, which is the reality for the GOP, is since the 2006 election cycle, the GOP has been in a downward spiral, lack of new ideas, lack of connection to the voters. The brand is in very poor form between the war, the unpopularity of the Republican president has made it very, very difficult. Congressional seats, I've predicted for 2 years now, if we walk away at the end of this cycle with 170 to 175 members of the House, it would be a blessing. I think the Dems will get close to 58, maybe 59 seats in the Senate. They won't hit the magic 60, but they will get right at the doorstep. So overall, it is not a pretty picture. Now, having said that, the one bright spot has been John McCain. As one Democrat operative put it to me, leave it to the Democrats to nominate the one guy who could lose this year and the Republicans to nominate the one guy who could beat him. And that is, I think that's a testament to what we've seen get played out across the board here, that the Republicans are in this game because of the McCain campaign and because of his general resonance among the population. They've known him for a while. He's someone that they have some history with and can appreciate the various positions that he holds. And so it's made this race much closer than it otherwise would be. It doesn't change the dynamics necessarily for us downstream. I'm finding around the country that there's still struggles. But at the top of the ticket, there's at least a fighting chance.
All right. I actually want to play a little bit of you. I was in the hall during the Republican National Convention, and there was a lot of love from the crowd.
We are Americans prepared to reach out to each other for a cause greater than ourselves. We recognize that leadership is not often tested in good times, but rather during those times of uncertainty, when one's judgment, strength of character, and experience comes together to reassure, to calm, and to guide us.
Now, what we didn't hear was a huge, thunderous applause that you got from the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Would you run for office again, and if so, what office?
I do. I would like to run for office. I really believe very firmly in public service. I enjoyed my years as lieutenant governor. As a small government Republican, really began to appreciate beyond the rhetoric of just saying, you know, I want a smaller government, but really focusing on how you make government work for people and how you make it efficient, efficient partner in our daily lives. And I walked away from the office with a great appreciation for the value of public service and the importance that you can play in helping small businesses, in getting health care where it needs to be, and in dealing with problems of crime and the things that lead up to people to do things that create problems in their community, recidivism and drug addiction and things like that. So, I'd like to get back to it. I'd like to run for governor of Maryland one day. And we'll see if that ever happens. But yeah, it's on the table. I don't know if it's in the cards yet, but it's at least on the table.
So you're chair of GOPAC, and
right.
It aims to elect more Republicans into office. So what are you working on specifically this time around? Are there any races or any strategies you're working on?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I mean, we've got a number of races. For example, in the 3rd Congressional District in Georgia, we have a young woman, a doctor, a medical doctor, Deborah Honeycutt, who is a very attractive African-American candidate for Congress, running a very competitive race there. And we've got a number of state legislative races that we're involved in, even including here in the District of Columbia, Patrick Mara, who's running for the city council citywide and as an at-large member. The House of Delegates race in California, if we are lightning strikes, we'll be able to elect the first African-American Republican in over 75 years to the state legislature in California. So there are some bright spots that we have been involved in. And the key thing for me has been emphasizing the quality of leadership, having men and women who represent the communities they come from. I can't run a conservative in a district that's largely moderate. nor can I run a moderate in a district that's largely conservative. What we have to do is identify individuals who bring certain strengths relevant to the place they live, the community they're from, and have them go out and speak to those issues that are important to folks. And we're finding great success in doing that. And so the proof will be in the pudding in November, whether or not any or all of them get elected. But at least it's a strategy that I've been trying to put into place over the past year. And so we'll see if it works, at least in terms of attracting the candidates and making races more competitive than they otherwise would be, particularly in a cycle like this where the Republican brand, as I mentioned, is not the most popular thing in the neighborhood.
Well,
we're being competitive.
Give me, and this is going to have to be really tight,
sure,
if you could do one thing that you think would bring more black folks to the Republican Party, what would it be?
Talk to them. Actually engage the black community where they are. Stop thinking you're going to get by having a handshake and a photo op, and actually go and listen to black folks in the issues and the concerns they have and make them relevant to the platform of our party and make them important to the overall strategy of not just, talking about the issues, but responding by listening first.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Michael Steele, chairman of GOPAC, a political action committee working to elect Republicans to office. He's also the former lieutenant governor of Maryland and a Fox News contributor. And just ahead, how do you get black voters of different backgrounds to the polls? Are there still barriers to voting based on race? We continue our month-long series on voting with a look at getting out the vote. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Black voters can turn the tide of an election. We've had to fight hard to get the vote, from the Emancipation Proclamation to the Civil Rights Movement and beyond. We now continue our month-long series on voting. Today we're going to dig into the nature of black voting patterns and whether there are still ways black voters are being steered away from the polls. In a minute, we'll hear from someone from a voter participation outreach group. But now, Earl Afari Hutchinson is going to give us a little historical context. He's an L.A.-based political analyst and author of The Ethnic Presidency, How Race Decides the Race to the White House. Great to have you in again.
My pleasure.
So you recently wrote an article for the Huffington Post called Why 8 Million or More African Americans Are Unregistered. Break down who these folks are.
Well, they come from a variety of segments, demographic segments. It's not monolithic, as many people think. When I say that, many people think, oh, these are just poor African Americans, inner city. Not necessarily so. They span all the demographic reaches. Many are middle class, working class, low income, male, female, different ethnic, or I should say religious persuasions, social persuasions. The big question is, why are there so many? This comes up over and over again in one of the most important elections in the last half century, where we obviously have certainly so much at stake with an African-American on the poise of making history as being the first African-American president. Why are so many African-Americans unregistered? By the way, that 8 million is low. Actually, the figure is more like 10 to 11 million African-Americans that are unregistered. So there's a variety of reasons. Many just simply say the standard reasons: lazy, ignorant, indifferent, uninformed, or cynical about the system. All of those certainly are there. But there's much more than that, and that leads us into the suppression, the historic suppression of African Americans as voters. And many of those things that have happened in the past, despite all the court rulings, despite all the lawsuits, despite all the public attention on voter suppression, they're still very much on the table this election.
What is the nature of voter suppression today as opposed to in the past?
the old crude stuff of the past where we had literacy tests, poll taxes, and out-and-out fraud, and also physical intimidation, those are things of the past. And even the things that we saw in the 2000 presidential election, if you remember in Florida and a couple of other states, but especially Florida, the hanging chads, purging voter rolls and so forth, huge controversy about that. Well, since then, the ways that votes are suppressed have become much more sophisticated. Right off the top, letter writing. Even though there have been a number of court rulings that say that you can, the GOP, because they were certainly the prime offenders, sending letters out to see if someone actually lives in an address, and then if the letters do not come back, then they can say, ah, you see, they don't live there, therefore they're not a legal registered voter, and they would be challenged at the polls. A lot of that went on in Ohio. Well, what happened was federal rulings prohibited that, but it was only aimed at the Republican National Committee. State and local committees can do it. Volunteer groups can do it. We're going to see a lot of that this time around. Second thing, voter ID, a photo ID. Remember the April Supreme Court ruling saying in Indiana and other states, got to have a photo ID.
Well, I'm actually going to bring in Melanie Campbell. She is the executive director of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. That's a nonpartisan group that tries to increase voter participation in the African American community. Hey, Melanie.
Hi there, Fry. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Hi.
So,
Errol.
How are you?
Great.
Very good.
So we're going to have you guys in conversation, but Melanie, let's talk a little bit more about what you do. You're getting people registered all over the country. What is your tactic? Is it feet on the street, mail? What are you doing?
We've just about finished our voter registration efforts, but it's been the traditional ways as well as online this time because that process has helped increase and more people are open to the idea of registering, utilizing online. But we're in the midst right now of doing something called our Vote First campaign to try one of the biggest problems people are going to have and have had in the last, and we saw that happen in the primaries, is not knowing where to go vote, having bad information, end up using provisional ballots. The other is that these states are not prepared for the type of turnout. Some of them are not prepared because they don't want to be prepared, and some of them just not prepared because they don't have the money to address long lines. So we're utilizing early voting as much as possible to try to alleviate that. In Georgia, for instance, where we have our Unity 08 campaign going, in Clayton County, I believe I'm correct, has already 10% of the voters have already voted in Clayton County, which is one of the suburban areas of Atlanta.
Explain the difference, because there's early voting and then there is absentee voting. What's the difference between those two?
Well, in some states, they call it something different. So the best way to describe it is early voting means that states have set aside early, longer times for you to go in and walk in and vote if that's what they have available for you. Some places call it absentee or no-fault absentee. What we have on our website, www.blackcampaign.org, you can go up and find out what your state allows for you to do. And some people, it may be absentee, but they just call it in jargon early voting. So it gets confusing when you try to, because every state is different. And so we've got all 50 states and what you can do. What you can do, some places require you to have a reason for absentee voting. And so we're just utilizing that Vote First message to get people to vote early, vote absentee, or be one of the first in line because the lines are going to be long. You are already seeing turnout levels that are off the charts where you do have early voting, where people are in line for hours because there's not enough machines.
Let me get Earl into this. How big an issue do you think it's going to be to have access to an adequate number of ballot boxes or booths?
I think it's going to be a crucial issue because, remember, one of the things when we talk about voter suppression, it's not overt, it's not crude, the old stuff, that's out. Essentially, just the absence, and certainly it's correct with those that are actually out there on the front lines, they see the absence of many places to actually go vote in primarily minority communities. In other words, you have to have access. Then once you have the access, then are the ballots there? Do you have the voting materials there? Is everything in place? That's been the big complaint in the past, certainly in certain areas. It's not there. So this is something that we have to look out for, and we know that there's going to be thousands and thousands of poll workers out there that are going to be watching hawk-like to make sure, first of all, polls are there, secondly, the materials are there. So I think this is so crucial, and as you know, the election's really coming down to 3 or 4 states. And when that happens, voter suppression in any of those 3 or 4 states that in any way, shape, or form that could cut down the numbers could actually be very damaging to one or other of the candidates.
Earl, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, the congresswoman who passed away this year, made a point of stating that she was horrified by how some of the people in her district and in Ohio were given what she felt were inadequate polling voting opportunities in 2004. How does a challenge or a statement like that affect what's happening this time? I mean, was it essentially just a paper protest, or do you think that people are paying attention to that issue?
I think people not only are paying attention to it, but people have to pay attention to it. It still comes back to this. You have to have access. We already know there's a great deal of enthusiasm. There's been a huge mobilization effort on the part of the different campaign committees, both local, national, and certainly statewide, to get people out, to get people registered. Now, people are registering, and as we're hearing, now people are showing up for certainly early voting and certainly absentee balloting. That's going to be off the chart. But it still comes down to this. You got to know where the polling place is. You got to have the materials there, and you got to have access. If that doesn't, if there's any breakdown in any way, shape, or form, that could appreciably cut into the vote. So this was not a false warning, and this was certainly not just a paper challenge. It's a very real challenge that has to be made.
Melanie, again, you're a director, executive director of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. You do have a lot of groups out there trying to focus on getting black voters equal access to the polls, including the NAACP. So do you coordinate at all? Do you try to
talk? Oh, yes. We have something called the Unity 08 campaign, and all of our organizations, traditional and non-traditional, you know, you remember Black You Vote. We're out there right now partnered with Bow Wow, going on his tour, helping to finalize voter registration as well as start getting out the vote. We're in 11 states where we actually have ground operations that's been going on all year through the primaries and, of course, now. And a couple of things that we really want people to know, Earl mentioned a very good point. We study what happens in the elections now, so we know how to try to improve it. Poll location, knowing where to go vote, critical. So we have a free hotline. 1-866 MyVote1 gives you that. There are many websites out there. People need to prepare to go vote. And if folks are in that kind of mindset, it is a determination that I have not. I've been doing this, been at this organization 15 years, and I have not seen the level of excitement and enthusiasm and determination that's out there. So the biggest challenge we have are the kind of games that get played, you know, out there now with the voter purges that folks know are against the law that are going on in Colorado, in Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Nevada, and North Carolina. Very, very key places. Georgia, folks are being warned about voter citizenship checks. In Alabama, they won't even let our folks register people in Jefferson County, Birmingham, Alabama, in 2008. There were people who are incarcerated, who are waiting, who are eligible to register, stopped allowing that to happen, won't let them give them absentee ballot information, nothing. And so there's a lot of things in the lawyer groups that we're working with, NACP Legal Defense Fund and Advancement Project and people, and very miserable, and we're trying to work. We just finished a meeting over there at NCNW with our legal groups, our folks on the ground, and doing everything we can. So it's information, and I appreciate you having this series, because information is what's going to be the course. The other challenge is, where 4 years ago, Internet, of course, has been nothing doing but growing. Internet this time, in this election, is much more pervasive in getting out that bad information. So it's being able to get the information to counter that, about whether or not you can or you cannot wear your paraphernalia when you go vote.
Can you or not?
Go ahead. I said,
can you or not? Because that...
Well, it depends on where you are. So what we decided in all of our groups is to tell folks the best thing to do, because poll workers a lot of times have good intentions. They may not know the laws. And so what we're saying is it's best not to.
Don't wear an Obama or McCain T-shirt.
Don't wear Obama, McCain, Buttons, T-shirts, whatever, when you go vote. You know, go in there. Just to avoid any problems. It's all about not denying you your right, but all the legal groups have decided that's the best way to avoid that problem.
Let me get Earl in on a different issue, which is that there is constantly this tension in the discussion of voter disenfranchisement between the idea that some people who should be allowed to vote are being prevented from voting, and the other opposite idea that some people who should not be allowed to vote, whether they're dead people or, you know, people who don't qualify, you know, are being registered. And to that point, on Tuesday, state authorities raided the Las Vegas offices of ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. The group admitted there was some fraud in their voter registration, and that was the reason for the raid, was allegations of fraud. ACORN released a statement saying that they were blaming saying that it was a single canvasser who did the fraud. The Secretary of State's office in Nevada said the purpose of the raid was to determine who's at fault, and that raid came 2 months after state and federal authorities created an election fraud task force in Nevada. Now, ACORN is not specifically a black organization, but to some people, because it works with low-income folks, it is sort of a code for
a partisan organization.
Yeah. So do you think that this admission that there was fraud, at least at some level, could hurt the back and forth over what's an appropriate line for voter checks?
Well, I think that's the intent. Certainly in Nevada, we have seen state and local organizations and volunteer groups at every step of the way they're going to raise some challenge. Particularly when we look at ACORN, remember in 2004 they put out Project Vote Report, which documented a 50-year history of Republican GOP suppression of minority voters. So ACORN's an obvious target. Will it have a chilling effect? Should it have a chilling effect? Obviously, the intent is to have a chilling effect on groups like ACORN, which are seen as totally biased toward the Democratic Party, not objective at all. Should it have a chilling effect? No, because ACORN has done a pretty good job, a very balanced job when you look at their reports in terms of documenting voter suppression and voter fraud. So I don't think this should be an issue here, whether one individual, the fault of one individual, even several individuals did it. This is one place, one time. For Ray, as you know, this is a national election, a 50-state election, not just one precinct or one district in one state.
Melanie, how tough is it for you to stick to regulations? I mean, is there a lot of regulation of voter registration?
The thing, before I came here, I lived many of my years in Atlanta, Georgia, working with the NAACP, so I've been doing voter registration since I was a student. The biggest challenge that you have is the process of getting away from volunteerism as a means of doing this kind of work. I got involved in it as a student because the NAACP recruited me to be a volunteer on doing voter registration. What we are advocating for is that we get back to the idea of people volunteering their time and not getting into where you call somewhat of a bounty system, so to speak, where people get paid to register people to vote, and to get away from that. And really, this election cycle, most of the people who are registering it's a volunteer effort for the most part, in most cases. You got these millions that are being registered, but you don't have the same kind of things. The last two election cycles, 2004 and 2006, you saw more of that kind of effort. So we're glad to see people doing it on their own. People are registering their neighbors.
All right,
that's
Melanie,
where we need to go back to.
I have to jump in really quickly from each of you. What should folks do if they're having problems on Election Day?
Two things. Number one, the challenge is there. If, in fact, you know that there's a problem, what you have to do is you have to certainly notify the local campaign headquarters, Democrat or Republican. There are attorneys out there. They'll be right on the spot. That should be the thing. And the second thing is that people should be on that day. They should be there at the polls and certainly armed with the fact that we have their legal identification, if it's a photo ID or whatever, and therefore they are legally registered to vote and entitled to vote.
All right, Melanie.
Don't leave.
One sentence.
If you know that you are registered to vote, do not leave that polling place. Right. Make sure you find someone. There'll be plenty of folks out there working to make sure that you know. Go. And the second thing is, know where you're going to go vote. Because if
all right,
you're in
Melanie.
That long line, you're going to have problems if you're in the wrong location. Your vote won't count.
Okay, Melanie, Earl, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We were speaking with Melanie Campbell, Executive Director of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, and Earl Afari Hutchinson, an L.A.-based author and political analyst. He was at NPR West. Coming up on News and Notes, we discuss all the sports you can handle on our Sports Bloggers Roundtable. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It is time to put sports on instant replay with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, it's playoff time in baseball, and if you're just a casual fan, this is when you probably perk up a little bit and start paying attention as we get closer to the World Series in a couple of weeks. So with me now are two excellent sports minds who have been paying attention all year long, and not just to baseball. D. Will writes for the blog Sports on My Mind, and Greg Lee is online editor for the Boston Globe. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's going on,
Tony? Let's talk a little baseball, shall we? In most sports, if you have the number one record, you are probably going to make it past the first round. But this year, the two teams with the best records in baseball were knocked out of the playoffs early. Of course, I'm talking about the L.A. Angels of Anaheim and the Chicago Cubs, the teams with the top records in the American and National Leagues, both of them now home, watching the playoffs like the rest of us. D. Will, are these the kinds of surprises that make fans happy or just drive them crazy?
I think both, Tony, actually. Chicago, people wanted to see Chicago advance. It is the 100th year since they last won a World Series, so everyone was excited about that. At the same time, they were a vastly overrated club because the National League is a little bit down this year. As far as Los Angeles, they have had problems over the last few years defeating the Boston Red Sox in the postseason. So it wasn't that much of a surprise. However, people are both surprised, and they are flummoxed, and all of that. So,
absolutely. Yes. Well, Greg Lee, you know, in the NLCS, which is coming up, we have the L.A. Dodgers starting a 7-game series today, in fact, against Philadelphia. Two things for you. Who do you see coming up on top? Because the Dodgers won the division and swept the Cubs in the NLDS, but the last time the Dodgers played in Philly, they were swept.
Well, I think it's a different Dodgers team now that Manny Ramirez is there. He's really hitting the ball real well, and his team is feeding off his energy. And I think that the Dodgers will beat the Phillies for the simple fact that Manny Ramirez has been there, done that with his two World Series rings that he brought on from Boston. And I really think he's really motivated to get to the World Series and hopefully face his old team.
Well, you know what, D. Will? On Friday, the Tampa Bay Rays square off against the Boston Red Sox in the American League. They meet at Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg. These teams really don't like each other, do they? I mean, I remember their big bench-clearing brawl back in June.
Right, yes. Tampa Bay has grown in stature and maturity, and actually they don't like the Yankees, they don't like Boston, they don't like any of the AL East teams they play against. And this is going to be very interesting. I think Tampa might actually beat Boston, even though I personally want to see Boston and L.A. play in the World Series. I think Tampa might do it because they have a never-say-die attitude, and I think they have as many clutch hitters as the Red Sox
do. And they have good pitching as well. But to Greg's, D. Will's point, Greg, seems like a lot of folks want to see L.A. and the Red Sox. Of course, Manny is one reason for that, but is that the only reason?
There are several reasons. Around here, we call L.A. Dodgers Boston West. I mean, there's a lot of storylines there. You have Frank McCourt, the Boston real estate mogul, who owns the Dodgers. There's a lot of Dodgers who used to play for the Red Sox, including Derek Lowe.
And Garcia Parra.
Nomar Garcia Parra.
That's right.
So there's a lot of connections there. And remember, the manager is Joe Torre, who's had a lot of battles with the Red Sox. So there's so many different storylines outside of the obvious with Manny Ramirez being traded in midseason this year.
All right, we'll have to follow and see how that goes. Let's move on to college football, gentlemen. We've got a couple of big college football games this week. Number one ranked Oklahoma taking on fifth ranked Texas in a Big 12 matchup. Defending national champion and fourth ranked LSU goes to the Swamp at number 11 Florida in a SEC matchup. Give me your thoughts about that first, D. Will.
These are two excellent matchups. I'm down here in Austin, so you can imagine everything's at a fever pitch down here. I think Oklahoma actually is the better team this year. They are amazing on both sides of the ball. As far as the battle in the swamp is concerned, it's going to be a defensive struggle that I think LSU might just win.
Really? What do you think?
Obviously, in Texas and in Oklahoma, you know, both teams have two great quarterbacks in Colt McCoy in Texas and Sam Bradford in Oklahoma. But I really think Oklahoma, yes, as D-World mentioned, have it on both sides of the ball. Their defense is very dominating and suffocating. I think the Sooners will, you know, take care of Texas. As far as LSU and Florida, being a Louisiana bred than I am, I really think the LSU's defense really will go down there into the swamp and beat Florida. I think Florida, you know, showed a little weakness when they lost to Ole Miss, maybe of lack of focus. Mm-hmm. But losing to Ole Miss was not a good thing for Florida. And I really think LSU is really, really finding themselves and finding their groove, especially with their young quarterback, Jarrett Lee, who really stepped up big time a couple weeks ago in Auburn and led LSU to the victory at Auburn.
Greg Lee, I'm going to have to stop calling you Boston and start calling you Baton Rouge, I suppose. I think one of the interesting side stories, guys, this season is that some of the smaller schools are doing really well. Talking now about Brigham Young, Boise State, they're in the top 20. And also Tiny Ball State has even cracked AP's top 25. Aren't these schools, D. Will, supposed to have inferior programs, at least compared to the big Division I-A schools?
Well, yes, they do as far as depth is concerned, but the starters on both sides of the ball for these smaller schools are equal now in talent to the larger schools. And as long as they can avoid injuries or get into a smash-mouth type of game, the way the college offensive systems are, they can spread the field, run the ball. As long as you have a good set of core athletes, these smaller schools can keep up. And with the multitude of athletes across the country and the fewer scholarships that are allowed in college football, it allows these athletes to go to smaller schools. So I think this is great, and I think it's going to continue.
That was my question to you, Greg. How are these schools getting these athletes? And D. Will just partly explained it.
Yes. Yes, everyone is now limited to 85 scholarships. So scholarships are spread out more across the country. And we have to realize, too, college football is on TV everywhere. So everyone is getting a piece of that national exposure that every high school senior is looking for when they go to college. Just because they can't get into Michigan, and Michigan's always on TV, they can get into the Ball States because Ball State is shown on TV. Brigham Young is shown on the Mountain Network in the Mountain West. So it's shown nationally on DirecTV and that sort. So with the number of scholarships and plus TV exposure being increased even more so for all these schools to be exposed, a lot of kids are going to different types of schools outside of the Michigans and the Floridas.
Let me come to you, D. Will. I got another college football question because we have seen a lot of upsets at the college level so far this season, and a lot of these upsets seem to be coming during weekday games, like on Thursday.
Yes.
USC versus Oregon, just one example, a couple of weeks ago. This is, of course, a television phenomenon, putting the games on Thursday. And I know that programs do get a certain amount of exposure from those weekday games, but it seems to me, and I'd like your opinion, that playing midweek cannot be helpful to the student athlete.
No, it isn't. And particularly for the bigger schools, they don't need the exposure. They don't need to build a reputation. For the smaller schools like Oregon State, say, and it is a large school, but it's smaller in stature than USC is as far as its football program is concerned. That game was a Super Bowl type of game or national championship game for Oregon State. It is their one chance to play on national television and show the country what they're about. In the case of Oregon State, they came off a bye week. They had 9 full days to prepare for that game, and this was everything to them. And that's how these upsets occur. Additionally, for the larger schools and the athletes in those schools, the athletes who are going to be professionals, those games often can only hurt their status in the NFL, coming NFL draft. A bad game on national television during the middle of the week when it's the only game on television can drop their draft stock from a first-round draft choice to a third-round draft choice because the sports jocks and the ESPNs of the world will never let you forget that they had that bad game under, quote, pressure.
You know, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Let's talk, though, about the guys that play on Sunday now instead of the guys that just play on Saturday and Thursday and whenever the heck they play. He is back, gentlemen.
Adam Pac-Man Jones is in Dutch again. The Dallas Cowboys DB reportedly involved in an altercation with the bodyguard who was hired by his own team to keep him out of trouble. Happened after an after party at a posh hotel in downtown Dallas Wednesday night. And get this, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, the man who let Jones back in the league after a long suspension, was in town at the time. Ouch, somebody is going to the principal's office today. What do you say?
Some people never learn.
How many chances are they going to give this brother?
The guy's very talented.
He is talented, but yes. I mean, come on. You know, he's talented on Sunday, but he's not too talented on Saturday night, apparently.
Well, some people, that's true. Some people just don't learn, and Pac-Man Jones, in his case, sitting out, you think of sitting out a year from the NFL, that he have learned his lesson, that, you know, he wasn't getting any income coming in, got suspended, realized that this is his, you know, hopefully that he had some perspective sitting out for a year, but obviously what has allegedly happened Wednesday night, a Pac-Man is could be, you know, in trouble again.
He could be in trouble again, for sure. Another guy who was in trouble just recently with his team, D. Will, Plaxico Burress of the New York Giants, he was suspended for 2 weeks, including including last week's game against the Seahawks. Now, he was AWOL and said he had to take his kid to school, didn't call anybody to let them know, and then after the suspension he said, no, I'm not sorry, but the next time I will at least pick up a telephone. Now, the Giants won without him, so what's going on with the G-men?
I don't think anything's going on with the G-men. As a matter of fact, all of his teammates love him. They support him. And they don't find that there's a problem with him. Actually, the problem is more, to me at least, a media creation than it is an in-house creation. Plaxico Burress is known within the locker room as being one of those tardy people. He's, you know, and people, some people are like that. They're just late people. And he is one of those people. He's constantly late for meetings, constantly forgetting to call the offices, et cetera. And in this case, he's estranged from his wife. His son was having a problem, needed to get to school, et cetera, as you said. He did what he had to do. Yes, he forgot to call the team. He's been fined over and over and over for this type of thing. It's nothing new for him. And his reaction to it actually spoke to that fact that it is really nothing new and no big deal. It's all water under the bridge and everything's okay.
What is it, Greg Lee, about these wide receivers? T.O., Randy Moss, Chad Ocho Cinco. I mean, these guys, they are like crazy. Why is that?
Receivers, you know, they're kind of guys who they thrive in the spotlight. They want the ball. They feel like they need the ball. It's a very extravagant position. I love T.O., I love Ocho Cinco. I love the wide receiver position, but at the same time, a lot of his receivers, yeah, they do get under the skin of some fans and even some of their teammates. But at the same time, T.O. is very passionate. T.O. gets out in the field. He practices hard. He plays real hard. He goes all out. Ocho Cinco is the same way.
You're right.
So although some receivers get a bad rap, but the reality is that they're really hard workers, and they wouldn't be the players that they are today if they didn't put any hard work or any time into it. So I really look at that more so the flamboyance of the receiver position. But it is what it is with that position, and you got to accept it. And within the case of the T.O.'s and Ocho Cinco's and the Plaxico Burress's, hey, Plaxico caught a winning touchdown in the Super Bowl. T.O. constantly produces. So I have no problem with it.
You're right. High risk, high reward. All right, guys, we're going to end Sports Bloggers this week on this topic. It is October, which means this is the one month of the year where every major sport is going, including the Big Four, baseball, football, basketball, even hockey, for crying out loud, plus college football. How many games do you guys watch a week? How many TV sets do you have going? I got about 30 seconds for you, D. Will, on that.
I actually have 3 televisions, DirecTV, and a full package for everything. So, and of course, I'm sitting with a laptop as well. So I'm watching sports all the time.
Really? What about you, Greg? How many TVs going on in your house at the same time?
3 with TiVo, and you know, I have all the packages. And when I'm not home, I can get the DirecTV NFL package on my laptop. So when I'm away, I can watch football on my laptop. So it's the NFL.
I feel you guys. I have one station on in my office, another station on in the family room, and another station on in the kitchen. So when I'm going back and forth and back and forth, I don't miss any of any of the action. One final, really, really quick note about basketball. Elgin Baylor, the Hall of Famer, let go by the Clippers. There may be some legal action. The team has been a laughingstock for so long. I'm going to just ask you really quickly, D. Will, in about 10 seconds, was this deserved, do you think?
Yes. It's Elgin Baylor has presided over a losing program for 20 years now. It's about time a change was made.
Yeah, it's too bad. He was a great guy, but the team, they suck. There's just no way of putting it another way. All right. True. Greg Lee is an online sports writer for the Boston Globe. He joined us from WBUR in Boston. D. Will writes for the blog Sports on My Mind. He came to us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas.
And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
I am doing great. So what are folks saying this week?
Well, as you can imagine, we got some letters about our economy coverage. On a blogger's roundtable last week, we discussed reports that some were blaming the mortgage crisis on African Americans and other minorities.
Matt Luazzo wrote us this. What I believe should be clarified is that the regulation requiring lending to people that using credit standards previously prevailing could not obtain credit led to lending with higher risk. In addition, this regulation required no discrimination as to interest rate.
Then John Huey commented on the month-long series we're doing on voting. He wrote, "Your guests made no mention of the real problems with the U.S. voting system. The system is designed to protect incumbents. It's much harder to register and vote in the U.S. than in other countries, and our winner-take-all system gives runners-up no consideration."
Listener Jennifer Combs wrote in after listening to a Bloggers Roundtable segment on Monday. She said News and Notes is not benefiting from using so many bloggers as commentators / analysts. The show would get sharper, more focused analysis from academics, nonprofit leaders, and print or TV reporters.
And finally, we heard from Sandra Bowen, who listens to us from Raleigh, North Carolina. She wrote in after she heard our political contributors say you, Farai, would be a good host for a presidential debate. Your show today with Donna Brazile and others was magnificent. Donna hits home, and I love her for that, especially the comment she made at the end, stating that you would be a good candidate to conduct the presidential debate. You've got my vote. And thanks for your letters. Please keep your comments coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we speak to some first-time voters about their inaugural visit to the polls. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.